Take two. My name is Luigi. I'm 25 years old. Today's date is March 9th, 2020, and I'm in beautiful Las Cruces, New Mexico, with Timothy, a retired veteran, and I'm going to get to know him a little bit.
Timothy Patrick Aloysius Kane, 78, going on 79. Today's March 9th, 2020, and I'm in the studio of KRWG in Las Cruces, New Mexico, on the campus of New Mexico State University, and with Luigi, my new friend.
All right. For a little bit of background, Timothy, can you tell us about where you grew up and what that was like?
Washington, D.C. is my birthplace, but I grew up in Montgomery County, Maryland, immediately north of D.C. Interesting times. This is 1941. It's unbelievable that on my parents' deed, it says they could not sell their house to a person of the Jewish religion or African-American descent. And I knew no black people. I knew no Spanish people. It was an interesting place in that sense. Local record stores would not sell a black artist. And this is Maryland, north of D.C. You would think it'd be progressive or not so racist, but fortunately, I went to high school in D.C., and a significant part of the class was black. The number one and number two guys in my class were black, so it really did have an influence, in my opinion, about all this nonsense. Mm-hmm. I went to college in Maryland, Mount St. Mary's College, and I was a scholarship kid. I couldn't afford it otherwise, and after graduation, I was commissioned in the Marine Corps, but we'll come to that later. But
do you have
Go ahead.
Do you have any siblings?
Yeah, two brothers, two sisters. One's deceased, my older brother, Michael, and he was a great big brother.
Very close in age?
3 years.
Okay, so pretty close.
Yeah, and was born, of course, just before Pearl Harbor. And my father went off to the Navy when I was about, less than a year old. And I didn't see him until I was five. So it was kind of an interesting deprivation.
Do you remember what that was like?
No. I have very few memories between the age of birth and four or five. But I do remember him coming home, and I said, "Who's this strange man hugging my mother?" And but I think it has its downside, growing up without a dad in those early years. Mm-hmm. I suspect that, you know, they're really crucial first 5-6 years of a kid's life.
Was it what was it like to build a relationship with your dad after he came home?
I don't know. You know, fathers then were kind of standoffish. They didn't do much for their kids anyhow. And my dad was a very loving, sweet man. But, dads didn't, for the most part, go play ball, didn't ride bicycles with their kids, didn't teach them anything.
You had a brother for that, right?
Yes. He was my big brother, my teacher, my mentor, yes. And later, you know, I developed a really nice relationship with my dad. And, in fact, he was my best man at my first wedding.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
And so you mentioned your dad went into the service and that you had gone into the Marine Corps. Did your brother go into the service before you?
Yes. My brother, Michael, the older brother, was in the Army. And he went to OCS on his own. I don't know why he did it. I think he did it because I was already a lieutenant or something in competition. My younger brother, David, went into the Navy, and he claims I kept him out of Vietnam because there was a policy about siblings serving at the same time in Vietnam, so he owes me big time.
Oh, yeah, that's a big one.
Yeah.
Did your father's military duty have a big influence on the three of you? Is that why you joined, or do you remember what it was?
Yes, he was very proud of his service, as most of those World War II guys were. And it was, you know, it was an important part of his life, and he talked about it often. And, you know, all our neighbors served in some capacity. Being near D.C., many were exempt because they had important government jobs. We had several naval laboratories and research centers all around D.C. And so there were some men there, but most dads either were involved in the war effort either through research and development or through active service. And yes, we grew up believing that we had a duty, that we should serve. And I strongly believed then, and I strongly believe it now, that I'm all for everybody having to serve a couple of years. Well, I don't care if it's a kid in a wheelchair, there's something he can do. And what a remarkable opportunity it would be for someone who thinks of themselves as other to serve.
When you went into the Marine Corps, was this at a time of they were drafting folks, or did you volunteer to go?
No, it's draft. So we all had to do something. Everybody my age in that my cohort group did something. They joined the reserves, they went active duty, or they just took their chances. But most guys were proactive. Most of my friends were proactive. Most joined the reserves, and that's fine. I'm all for that.
What year did you decide to enlist?
1959. I was 17 years old. I joined the Marine Corps Reserves.
17.
But it was a special program the Marine Corps had at that time. I don't think they have it anymore. It's called the Platoon Leader Class or Course, PLCs. Marine Corps is the only service that does not have an academy. We have Merchant Marine Academy, Naval, West Point, and Air Force Academy. Marine Corps doesn't. So they wanted their own stream of officer source, and they had this PLC program. I actually joined the Marine Corps Reserves. Had rank. We did 2 summers in Quantico to satisfy the 30-day requirement. And at graduation from college, you had the option of either taking a commission or just staying in the reserves. And I said, well, that's a win-win. I mean, if I didn't want to go, I just had to go to 2 years of weekend meetings, and I'd be all through. I mean, it was a terrific program, rather than being drafted with a 6-year obligation. Pardon me. So I joined the reserves and took the commission, and they promised me flight school, and they, in fact, sent me to flight school.
When you decided to join, do you remember telling your parents and your friends about it?
Yeah, because my parents had a sign. I wasn't 18, so they knew about it. And my friends in college, of course, knew. It was a very small school. There were only 120 guys in my graduating class. So,
how did your parents react when you told them about that?
I think they probably had mixed feelings. They probably thought, I think they just feared for me. But nothing was going on in 1959. I don't even think we had a few military advisors in Vietnam, but it was a very, very quiet time. I don't know if I would have made the same choice if it was 1969, when it was the height of the activity and the largest force, total numbers, in Vietnam were in the 68, 69, 70 time period. So I may have felt differently then, but not then. It was really quiet, and it was an opportunity to fulfill my obligation. And they're going to send me to flight school. What could be better?
Yeah. Right. So can you tell me about Quantico and tell me about flight school afterwards?
Sure. Well, Quantico was just for the summers. It was a neat program because every other Marine officer had to go through Quantico Officers Basic School, which if you're picked up for aviation, they said you don't need to know how to run around the woods, and that appealed to me anyhow. They never liked sleeping in the woods. So and graduation, short summer break, then off to flight school. It was in August sometime, I think. Don't remember the exact date, but August 63 to flight school for about 18 months. That was just great fun. Once I got used to flying, never been in an airplane, had no idea how to fly an airplane.
What was the first time like?
I threw up, and I threw up the next 6 times. They sent me to a shrink. Say, are you really suited for this? Yes, I am. I just get car sick. Oh, okay. And they let me stay. And I went on and became a pretty damn good pilot. So
Do you remember how you felt when you first started flying?
Oh, it's an amazing experience. If you've not been in a small plane and just fly around a couple thousand feet above the ground or 3,000 feet and see everything from that perspective, it's just amazing. And then it gets to even be more fun when you get to fly solo and you learn how to fly acrobatics. And yeah, there's nothing like it, truly. And actually, training, of course, is the best time, because after that, people start shooting at you. That's not so much fun. But at least during the training period, it was quite good. Couple of interesting experiences. I tend to fall asleep easily, so on night solo flights, twice I fell asleep. And once I woke up in a screaming dive and woke up about 1,500 feet off the ground. And then the other time I was in a very shallow dive and recaptured that at about 500 feet. So I determined that maybe flying alone was not the best thing for me.
What made you wake up?
I don't know. I have an angel. I mean, I should have been dead so many times in the military and post-military. I'm blessed. I think, I don't know if you guys are spiritual, but when I was in Vietnam, I thought I had not a guardian angel, but somebody there looking after me. And I named him. I even gave him a name, Golan. Golan was on my side and kept me alive.
Yeah?
Yeah.
My gosh, I can't imagine, you know, it's already kind of scary to fall asleep at the wheel, but to imagine.
Well, I do that driving now, you know, just... my wife does not like me driving at nighttime.
Me too. So after flight school, so I know it's quite a while later, but you mentioned you went to Vietnam. What were the years like between flight school and being deployed?
Oh, well, I had another war, Santo Domingo.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it was a little dust up down in the Caribbean. And, you know, Haiti and Santo Domingo joined in one island down there. And guy named Trujillo was president of the Dominican Republic. He was a thug, like many of them were and still are. And he was going to, there's a coup to get rid of him, but United Fruit Company was against him, not in favor of him being, or continuing to be president. So he started some mischief, and so President Johnson sent us down. And we had to evacuate all the U.S. citizens out of Santo Domingo, which were quite a few. And we did manage to get them out. We didn't lose any of them. We did lose some Marines. And I've got a funny story about that, and we'll get into that later. But that was my first experience with people shooting at me. And having escaped unscathed through that experience, really, when I was in Vietnam, I was never, while flying, never really afraid, which is interesting. Maybe I should have been, but I wasn't. It's only afterwards, and when you reflect back on the experience, you say, gosh, that was really stupid. Why'd you do that? And, after, that was in the spring of 65, so that was about a year after graduation or getting my wings. And then in August 15th, 1966, I was sent to Vietnam. And I only flew for about 4 months till Christmas Eve, 1966, upon which time I was sent to Wing Headquarters to be a fragmentation officer. And we were interviewed by the general and his staff, and there was five of us, I think, were interviewed. And I was the only one. I was told later I was the only one that said I didn't want the job. I want to stay flying. I want to keep doing what I do. I can't leave my squadron mates. And, of course, I'm the guy that gets the job. So the other four say, oh, yeah, I want the job. So, I mean, that's the military way, right? So, but best job I've ever had.
And what did that job entail?
Well, I was in charge of scheduling all the Marine Corps helicopters in Vietnam on that next day. So the requests would come in from various sources, mostly Marine Corps infantry units would request, but we had CIA, Coast Guard, Navy, and the ROC Marines. and the Rock Marines, the Republic of Korea Marine Corps, were just south of where we were stationed, and they had a whole division there. And so they had a lot of requests, which I usually denied. And so various sources. I, from time to time, depending on availability, and really there were maintenance issues, and most of the maintenance issues related to parts. And I scheduled 200 Marine Corps helicopters a day.
Wow.
Yeah. And it's great authority. That's why I said it's the best job I ever had, because of terms of responsibility, in terms of great power, and being trusted by senior staff. What I said went. I was in the 11 months I did that, no one ever questioned a decision, no one countermanded a decision. And I'll tell you a couple of stories later about that.
Yeah, you can tell me about it. Let's hear about it.
Well, let's go. Let me do a couple of things here before we get there. Well, here's some of the fun stuff. One of my first flights in Vietnam, I was in an H-34. H-34 was a plane that came into the system about 1955. It was old. It was an interim helicopter made by Sikorsky. Is to be replaced by the H-46. Which came online in the early 60s, and the Marine Corps is actually transferring out the H-34s and replacing them with the 46s in the 1966 time period. Pardon me. And so they gave us the guys that flew the old aircraft, these H-34s, they're going to get put out of service. All the dangerous, crappy jobs, because if we got blown up or shot up, we weren't losing a brand-new, very expensive aircraft. So we did mostly medical evacuations and recon inserts and extractions. So, and most of it was picking up wounded kids, wounded Marines. And that part of it made me feel good, because, you know, here we're saving a life instead of taking a life. And but one of my very first flights, where I was down, I was in the evening south of Phu Bai, where we were stationed, and pick up the litter, and we get about a couple thousand feet, and my crew chief says, "Sir, it's a fucking bear." And so somebody would have some fun with us, shot a bear, put a helmet on him, put his flak jacket on, covered him in his tarp. So just this was upper, really just his neck was showing. And they said, "What should we do? Should we throw him out?" And I said, "No, with our luck, we'll probably hit somebody and kill him or something." So no, I said, let's take him to the hospital. So we took him up to the hospital, and near, not the name, where were we? I know, the closest hospital. And the kids came running out and grabbed the litter, and they just run off, and we took off. Never heard the end of that. So that was kind of fun. Another interesting experience early on was that I was told to fly about 100 miles south of town, which is kind of risky. One, there's no one down there to help us out. My max range was about 180, 190 miles, and so I'm pushing it. So this guy runs out with an ammo box. I don't know if you see him, a little green steel box with a handle. And I said, "Where are we going?" And he gives me the location. I said, "What the heck are we going down there for?" He said, "Well, we gotta make a payment." "Really? What are we paying?" He said, "None of your business." So yeah, we take him down there. He hops out. I see him running over, and some guys run out of the bushes, and he hands him the box and runs over and gets back in my airplane. And I said to him en route, I said, "I'm going to stop this airplane right now and toss your ass out unless you tell me what that was all about." Well, we had to receive our aviation gas by oil tankers, just like you see at the gas station when they're filling up the tanks at the gas station. That's what we had to bring our fuel up from Da Nang to Phu Bai, because they didn't have the piping or something fixed yet to deliver aviation fuel to us directly. And so it turns out that the Viet Cong used to blow up the Marine Corps oil tankers all the time. And we said, well, that's not working. We have to figure out another way to do this. So they hire the South Vietnamese to do it. Well, then the South Vietnamese would just sell the gas to the Viet Cong. Well, that wouldn't work either. So we decided, I didn't have anything to do with the decision. It was decided that we will bribe the Viet Cong and promise them that we wouldn't come after them if they allowed contractors, American contractors, to drive these oil tankers from Da Nang to Phu Bai. And what I was delivering was the monetary payment for the next five or six oil tankers to come through. So here we are, risking life and limb to go down there and pay the enemy for permission to drive these oil tankers up there unscathed. So there's lots of craziness. That's when I started, not losing it, but just started questioning all of this. A couple other funny things. Once I was a fragmentation officer, I knew where my planes were going and what they were doing. And I noticed that one day there was a request for an aircraft to take 1,000 pounds of rice to a certain location. And I thought, geez, wait a minute. I checked and I said, I just delivered them 2,000 pounds of rice last week. And these are small regional outposts manned by usually mountainards or indigenous folks who were in the area. The CIA coordinated them, and but we would take them food and ammunition. And so I got in an airplane on my day off, and I flew up there. And here's this beautiful complex all made of cement. We never took any cement up to these guys. They had another way to get all this cement up there because they're in the top of a mountain. And I was speechless. I was gobstruck. And there's no one there. It didn't look like there was a battle or a fight. There wasn't any potholes in the cement or any sign of blood. So I walk around. I go to the edge of the mountain. I look down. And here are my guys down there playing soccer. So I've got some binoculars, and I look down. Here's my guys, these regional forces, playing soccer with a local VC cadre because it was Buddha's birthday. So they had their own unofficial little...
Holiday,
yeah. And I'm saying, oh, this is getting crazier and crazier. And anyhow, so much for Buddha's birthday, and I'm glad they had that chance to play soccer with one another. And
yeah, you mentioned that there are a few of these moments that you're starting to question things. Do you remember what you were thinking when you first got deployed to Vietnam?
No, I really didn't know. In fact, I was given orders. You had to have at least 13 months remaining on your contract to be sent to Vietnam, so I didn't get my orders till about 13 months and 2 weeks before the deadline. And so I didn't know what I was going on. I had mixed feelings. I said, well, I go or I don't go. It didn't seem like a real good deal. The guys coming back, reported some conflict. The number of deaths among helicopter crews was really minimal at that point. And so it was... you go do your duty. But I didn't feel strongly one way or another. I wasn't saying, I want to go. I want to do this. Even though I had not decided yet whether or not I was going to stay in the Marine Corps for my life, called lifers, or would I just finish my contract and get out. Some of the high points of being there, which were kind of fun, I flew John Steinbeck around Vietnam.
Whoa.
Yeah. He had two sons, and both served in the Army. I think they're both Army. I know one was Army, and one may have been Navy, but two sons who served. And John, I think he was just an old traditionalist. I don't think he was a warmonger. He was just a reporter. So he wanted to go and check it out, and he wanted to see where his son served. So I had to do some research, find out where that was, because he was in the Army. So I had Mr. Steinbeck in my airplane, flying him around and stopping and checking out some areas. We had almost no conversation. He was an old grump, funny old guy, craggy beard, and but he had a Marine Corps helmet on and a flak jacket and some old khakis and a blue work shirt. And I think he said, "Hello, I'm John Steinbeck." And I said, "Hello, I'm Timothy Kane. Nice to meet you, sir." And we kind of walked around and got back in the airplane and took him home. That was it. But I can at least have bragging rights that I flew him around.
Yeah.
He wrote a series of letters called Letters to Leisha. John was a friend of the editor of Newsweek magazine, and Newsweek editor owner was a big pal of Johnson, so there's all these connections, of course, and I think they expected John to write favorable things, but most of them were pretty neutral and just straight reporting.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't try to make a case for or against the war, but his editors didn't want them to be published because they thought it would reflect badly on John that he had taken a position on the war, and they just wanted to sell his novels. So. And they, even though that Newsweek did publish some of the letters, they were all combined in a book eventually, and published separately years after the war. My other big kick was I briefed General Omar Bradley. So I don't know if you guys know your World War II history, but he was one of the five-star generals,
mm-hmm.
and quite a gentleman, very successful in. He wanted to check out Vietnam. So he, unknown to me, came. His wife pushed him in a wheelchair over to my desk one day, and he said, "Son, tell me what's going on here." And so we had a long briefing, big map, and he said, "Thank you, son," and off he went. So that was the other highlight. As I was reflecting on my experiences there, I tried to think of some pleasant things, funny things, and not all horror and terror.
Yeah. So how long did you spend over in Vietnam?
August 15th, 1966 to October 30th, 1967. So what is that?
A little over a year.
14 months, 15 months. And
Do you remember what it was like coming home?
Yeah. Military being what it is, I lost my service jacket. They let me fly to California on my rotation date, but I had to wait around a couple of days till they found my service record to actually give me a release and sign off on my jacket. And I went to a local, I needed some toothpaste or something. And the dorm we were sleeping at was right near the gate, and there was a drugstore across there. It was much closer than walking to the PX. So I just walked across to the drugstore. I was in uniform, of course, and some woman spat on me. Now, afterwards I found out that that was not an uncommon event, and but I was just startled by it and said, "What in the world is that all about?" And I didn't say anything to her. I didn't confront her. I said, "Okay, she's got an issue. I don't know what it is." But, we were not welcomed with open arms, mm-hmm. the baby killers and so forth.
Was that, did you feel like it was hard to transition back to civilian life?
In that respect, yeah, because that was my welcome home. My wife at the time was not very supportive. Called her and I said, "I'm safe, I'm home, I'm in near San Francisco. I'll see you in 2 days." And he said, "You son of a bitch, I can't count on you for anything. You're supposed to be home today and you're not." And she slams the phone down. Welcome home. So that marriage didn't last.
And after you left Vietnam, did you transition out of the service entirely, or?
Yes. Well, they keep you in the reserves for a while, and I don't think I was officially released till late 70s,
mm-hmm.
when you actually get a discharge. So they hold you in the ready reserve for a number of years, depending on needs. And so it was.
What did you do during that time after you came?
I couldn't find a job. We were in a recession, which you guys, you know, wasn't like this one you guys experienced a couple of years ago. But we were in a recession. The war was very expensive. And so people were generally not hiring. The economy was not expanding. I considered a flying job, but there were no flying jobs. And just as well, because I would have fallen asleep and probably gotten fired or died with all my passengers someplace. But I even wrote that down. I kept a log of all the places I applied to. I sent out 98 applications for a job and got one call in. So, and that was with a research firm, that had government contracts. So they can at least consider my Vietnam experience valuable. Most didn't. Most employers didn't. I did not start there. I just went to normal places. And my wife was in Connecticut. I liked Connecticut very much. I would have liked to have lived there and worked there, and it just didn't work out. I knocked on lots of doors, and either they weren't hiring at all or they weren't hiring vets. Oh, okay.
So we've got about 10 minutes left, so I understood that there are a few reflections you wanted to share.
Yeah, because there are. Lots of things I wanted to say, but I'm not going to get to them. A couple of things that discouraged me about staying in the military indefinitely was I found out my commissioning date was set one day after the Naval Academy graduated. So in the military, you guys may not know, you have a president's order, and it depends on how you're listed in the book, the blue book. They call it like the blue book or some kind of a book. I would have been senior to every Naval Academy graduate that graduated that summer if they honestly recorded my commissioning date, because it goes by date. So they just put my date 2 days, a day after the Naval Academy, and that kind of ticked me off. And then I find out that all these Naval Academy guys that were going to flight school were sent down the summer between their junior and senior years and taught how to fly. So when we went down to compete with them, I'd never been in an airplane. They knew how to fly. It wasn't a fair, it wasn't a player. But that really ticked me off. The other thing that's probably little known, and I think it's important to say, the reason we got into Vietnam at all, lots of things have been said, but this I don't think has ever been said. John Kennedy, President Kennedy, knew Cardinal Archbishop Francis Spellman, who was chief of chaplains, of all the military chaplains. And it was Cardinal Spellman that asked Kennedy to help out South Vietnam, because that was Catholic. North was, of course, Buddhist. And so there was really a very religious element to this that was not just much discussed. Who knows what Kennedy would have done if Spellman didn't twist his arm about sending people over there. Most of the senior staff that I was with, and I was with generals and dealt with generals every day, and senior colonels, because I was at wing headquarters, and these were all World War II vets and Korean War vets. They had no enthusiasm for this war. That really did affect me in a way that I didn't realize until I'd gotten back. And upon reflection, if these guys have seen it all, think this is maybe not the best deal in the world, then maybe I shouldn't buy into it either. One thing that we did observe, and I have to do say that most of the kids that were there, these infancy kids, these kids that were 17, 18, 19 years old, just did remarkable jobs. It was a crappy, crappy place to be. Terrible conditions, terrible fears from lions and wild snakes and pits. They all did great. That some bitch smacked McNamara then, because they couldn't find enough bodies to send over there, loosened the restrictions and started sending over sub-IQ kids. These are kids that are really marginals, like 80, 85 IQ, which is damn low. And he started recruiting them and drafting them and sending them to Vietnam, which I think is something he's going to have to answer to. It was cold in Vietnam. I slept when I was in Khe Sanh up in the mountains. I slept with an Arctic sleeping bag, long johns, leather jacket, flight gloves, wool hat. I mean, I think it was a hot, steamy place, but the place is really cold. I went over there with four pilots. We met in San Francisco on the same orders. And of those four, one was killed in action. One was wounded three times. One was mortally wounded, and I don't know if you guys have been hearing that term, but I think it's a true response to some matters of conscience, which were some people. So I've got a good friend, and he's mortally wounded because of some of the things he did. He did them, and then on reflection, this is not right, but he still did them. And six Marines from my graduating class. Remember, small school, 120. Six of us went into the Marine Corps. One was killed in action. Four very early deaths, and I can't believe they weren't attributable to some kind of trauma. You know, they just shut down. And then there was me, who came out discouraged and depressed. There's been lots of reporting. Oh. General Westmoreland was head of ACFI, sued CBS for saying that they slandered him. They did not slander him because I was required to send him, like, reports of aircraft losses and after a major battle. The stuff would come out of headquarters. I mean, Washington, D.C., they're saying maybe 10 planes were shot down when I know there were 40 planes shot down. They were underreporting. But he sued because he was slandered, but he wasn't slandered. He underreported. And trauma went into a restaurant, and this was 30 years after coming home. I walked into an Asian restaurant, and I heard Vietnamese being spoken back here someplace. I dove on the floor. I was there with four clients. That was embarrassing. It's there and it comes back in unlikely ways. Just bought a chair from Costco and had the knife out, box cutter. I looked down and getting ready to cut it, and it says made in Vietnam, and I froze and I said this thing might be booby trapped. So,
how do you feel like? What has been helpful for you to cope with this?
Oh, about 5 years of therapy and prayer, forgiveness, asking for forgiveness. I think we shouldn't have been there. It's none of our business. And we cause all this death and destruction, and then we walk away from it. And now we're friends, we're trading partners. Why couldn't we be trading partners back in 1963? Okay, one wrap up. This is important to me. Very often people say, thank you for your service. And if there's any word I want to get out there to you young people and anybody that listen, that's not what you say. Thank you for your service. My service and everybody in Afghanistan coming back, they get thanked. That's Carl Rove's great genius, you know. Thank the servicemen, but don't criticize the war. When you say thank you for your service, you're saying thank you for going out and killing people. That was my job, to kill little yellow people. And the same thing in Afghanistan. So you're thanking me for that, and I'm saying, no, that doesn't sound right. So keep that in mind. I don't know how else to do that, and I take it as a... in the light it's given, I say thank you. But it would be better just to say welcome home. That's what we say among ourselves, veterans, when we meet another veteran who has served. Welcome home.
Another veteran suggested to me that they would like it if somebody said, instead of thank you for your service, what can I do for you today? And what do you think is the most important thing for taking care of our veterans coming home?
Yeah, we don't do enough. We don't do enough for the veterans. And well, thank you. Thank you for listening.
Yep, thank you for sharing with us today.
You're welcome.